and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is November 20th, 2025, and this is episode 564. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, out in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd, all one word. Again, I'm not on with the Warnerd himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, but I have a bit of an update on John. Good news. John's out of the hospital. He got out a few days ago, actually. And he's just now doing a lot of resting. And actually, he's recovering much better now. Like, I would say there was a time, I mean, you know, you never want to like, you don't want to jinx anything, but there was a time last week it just felt a little bit hairier, a little bit scarier. But this week, and based on what the doctors are saying, and, you know, I'd like to tell more, and we will as time goes, but he's actually recovering really well. And in fact, and I'm so damn annoyed, John called me just like an hour before we were going to do the show, but I was taking my kids to school, and then I didn't see it till later, because I'm still getting used to this whole WhatsApp thing that the kids are into. So I wrote back to his wife, and she said he was back sort of resting again. So either I'm going to try to call John, because I haven't spoken to him. I have a couple friends that spoke to him last week when he was still in the hospital. I haven't spoken to John. Well, I haven't spoken since he went in the hospital, but I've been in regular contact with Catherine, his wife. But I'm hoping to talk to him today. But again, I want to say he is recovering now very well. I don't want to pressure him at all to come back too soon to Radio Warnerd, although I know he really misses it. So we'll have to hold off. You know, I want to at least get a message from John pretty soon, not too quickly, not too soon, but a message from John. And we'll kind of slowly reintroduce him to the show without at all, you know, stressing him or taxing him. So anyway, that's good news on the Warnerd front. The counteroffensive has begun. So that said, I have with us today, we're going to have a really great show. I have a great guest co-host today, one of the subscriber favorites among our guests, Cyrus, is joining us to help me today, or co-host with me today, because we're doing an episode, a guest who is an expert on the UAE, which has been a regular subject of curiosity throughout the years of Radio Warnerd, now 10 years old. So Cyrus, first of all, welcome back to Radio Warnerd, and thanks for coming on as a co-host today and helping out.
My pleasure. Sorry it's because of these bad circumstances.
Yeah. I know, me too. But like I said, it's actually, we're kind of getting our first turning the corner good news this week. So you came on for, you know, the time when the news is getting a little better. So Cyrus, right now, before we bring on our guests, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing right now. You're in Baghdad. So you're talking to us from Baghdad. They just had an election in Iraq. And what can you tell us about the election results and, you know, maybe how the war, like the genocide, the war on Iran, how any of that has been influencing the elections?
Okay, so they had elections on November 11th. Mm-hmm. I think this is the seventh time they'll be changing government since the first election in 2005. And it was largely uneventful. They had more candidates than ever before, 7,000 candidates, many parties, no real policies or politics. So there was a higher turnout than previous years. But most people choose to whom they vote or for whom they vote based not so much on any ideological difference, but rather they tend to just like a candidate or he's a relative. because nobody's campaigning on any significant political differences when it comes to the economy or international relations, domestic policies. That's more or less the same. There are no Islamist parties or secular parties, really. To a large extent, it's a personality contest. Most people vote for somebody from their own sect.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, there is an unofficial system that resembles Lebanon's Taif sectarian system. So the prime minister is going to be Shia, Speaker of Parliament Sunni, the president Kurd. That's an unwritten law, but it's just the way it is. Shias, obviously, the majority of the population. They have the majority of seats in parliament. But there's also an unwritten law that each group will pick its candidate for that position based on consensus. So no Shia party will determine who's the prime minister alone. Rather, they all get together and negotiate on a prime minister. And then each Shia party will negotiate its slice of the pie in terms of ministers and director generals. But before that happens, the Sunnis get together and do the same thing and negotiate over a candidate for the Speaker of Parliament, taking into consideration that since Sunnis don't have a majority of seats, they have to have the Shia votes. So it has to be a Speaker of Parliament who's acceptable to the Shias. Then the Kurds, same thing will happen for the candidate for president, who's largely symbolic anyway. And then finally the Shias will produce their candidate. So we're talking of like 4 to 6 month process probably.
Wow.
Unlike past elections, this wasn't really contested. And there hasn't been as much foreign intervention as there usually is.
What do you mean this hasn't been contested?
Well, the results are often very contested.
Oh, I see.
There's a huge amount of fraud and corruption.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit less fraud and corruption this time around. But basically half, I'm just guessing here, but a large portion of the votes are bought. So in Anbar province, for example, and other Sunni majority provinces, you'll get paid $50 to $300 to vote for a candidate. So you're not necessarily voting for somebody you like, just somebody that is offering you more than somebody else. If you're a tribal sheikh, the leader of a tribe, you might get $150,000 because then you can just have a big tribal feast, get your people together, and tell them who they're going to vote for. And in other cases, if you're the owner of a company, like there's a large supermarket chain in Iraq, the owner of that company told all of his employees that they're expected to vote for him and bring a bunch of their relatives with them. Same thing for police captains or officers. They'll tell their guys who to vote for. Army officers will do the same thing. So candidates will pay commanders of security forces to tell their soldiers or men to whom they should vote. Political parties, ministers, they all find ways to not force. It's not exactly coerced because in the voting booth, nobody can tell for whom you're voting. But you're expected to bring a certain amount of relatives or friends and deliver votes for the party that got you a job, for example, in the ministry. So as a result, few people are voting on any real ideological basis, and therefore it's almost impossible to try to discern any ideological trends from election results because people aren't voting for any of those reasons. Sometimes they're just voting for a friend they like or a relative, and sometimes they're being intimidated to vote, or it's transactional. The deal is, this political party will get me a job in this ministry or security body, but as a result, I'm expected to deliver my family to vote for them on election day. What is interesting is that the Prime Minister Sudani got the highest number of Shia votes by a little bit, but not enough to really make a difference in terms of dominating. He got 92,000 votes. In 2014, Maliki, who's like the Darth Vader boogeyman for the West, got 700,000 votes.
Wow.
So basically all the Shia parties got a similar amount of, the big ones got a similar amount of votes. The headlines are maybe that the preferred candidate for the West, Sudani, and for the Gulf for that matter, didn't do as well as he'd hoped. He's not going to be prime minister again, probably. But he'll have a bunch of ministries. And the so-called pro-Iran or Iran-backed parties, which is very simplistic, did much better than expected.
Mm. Is that Muqtada al-Sadr?
No, he boycotted it.
Oh, okay.
So he didn't even take part. 4 years ago, Muqtada al-Sadr took part, was unhappy with the way negotiations were going down because he basically wanted to be the sole representative of the Shia parties and break that rule of a consensus-based system.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of stormed off and overthrew the table and took his ball home with him, if I can mix metaphors. But he attempted a coup, in effect, and had his militiamen storm the Green Zone,
right,
attempting to support the American-backed candidate, Kadhimi, Mustafa Kadhimi. That failed. He got ignominiously sort of smacked in the face. His forces were too weak to make a difference. He had his members of parliament resign, and so he's been unrepresented in the government for the last 4 years and also refused to take part in the current elections. So it's the other Shia parties, and they're basically going to propose a candidate who's acceptable to America and Iran. He'll have some kind of technocratic background, probably will have lived in Iraq all his life, not be in exile, and will have served in the government and have a relatively good reputation. It's actually pretty boring, which is great for Iraqis to have a boring country for the first time in many years.
One question is, how are Iraqis themselves sort of viewing democracy? If it's this kind of transactional and unideological, is it like, well, this is the way it is, this is like a way of life, and it's certainly better than, I don't know, something we had before, whether it was the period of all the violence and civil war or the period of Saddam Hussein?
So 56% of registered voters took part, which sounds high. But in reality, 41% of eligible voters took part, which suggests a high degree of voter apathy, which has been the case for a few years now in Iraq. So nobody is opposed to democracy and the peaceful transition of power and political parties determining who gets seats and all that. But nobody's very passionate about it either. And I think that's the case all over the world. Democracy isn't looking that good these days. I mean, they're electing fascists in Japan and in Argentina, and Europe is turning Nazi, and whatever is happening in America that nobody can really understand. So you could say that Iraq is the only democracy in the Middle East, with the exception of Lebanon.
Right. Maybe.
And it's among the most open societies in the Middle East, where almost everything is acceptable, save a few taboos. You can't criticize the senior ayatollahs, Sistani. There are things which you can say that might get you assassinated but won't get you arrested. But it's among the most open societies, with a plethora of TV stations representing every possible view and every community. And political parties, as I said, an overabundance of those. So it's taken for granted that this is a system and nobody is challenging it. There's no Islamist, Sunni or Shia objection to democracy or elections or the political process. There's a constitution that's more or less respected. It's a massively corrupt country, so people will cheat every way they can, but they accept that this is the system and they look for ways to cheat.
What about those massive and rather violent protests from, what was that, 2020 or 2021? I can't remember the exact year.
It started in October 2019.
Okay.
It's called the Tishreen protest. Tishreen means October in Arabic. Mm. That was typical of a lot of the spontaneous protests we see around the world that have been very well described by
Vince Bevins.
Vincent Bevins.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Volodymyr Yushchenko, I think, a Ukrainian leftist.
Both guests on Radio Warnerd. Plug. Yeah.
unemployed, underemployed, overeducated youth, frustrated with a corrupt political system. The protest is repressed with excessive violence by a government that is just recovering from ISIS and is also worried about the Trump administration. Leads to further violence, and then outside actors come in and try to take advantage of it, including the UAE. I think we'll end up talking about the role of the UAE in Iraq later, and Western-backed NGOs. But in the end, there's no leadership, no ideology, no goals, except this nihilistic thing of overthrow the system. And it kind of just loses momentum once the government resigned and a new prime minister took over. And there's almost nothing left of that movement. Some of the local leaders produced by that movement did attain seats in parliament 4 years ago. And in these elections, they were basically all run out of parliament because they hadn't been able to deliver anything. In part, they hadn't delivered anything because they weren't part of the patronage network. They didn't have ministries, so they couldn't hire people and go through the process I described earlier where you basically are paying people to vote for you.
Mm-hmm. What about...
So you could say that the elections were a victory for the status quo.
Right. Which you know, can be a really good thing in a country that's suffered enormously for so long. I mean, you can
right.
understand why
people want it. It's a massively wealthy country. So there is there's a growing middle class. Mm-hmm. Sudani, the outgoing prime minister, hired an additional 1 million people into government positions. And basically, that's the only job you have in Iraq is a government job. They depend on oil almost exclusively, and they benefited from the war in Ukraine because oil prices went up. Mm-hmm. But if oil prices ever crash, then you're going to have massive social disturbances because there is no alternative to the public sector. And this bloated employment rate in the public sector. But for now, Iraq is more safe and stable than it's been in 50 years, more open than it's been since the 70s as well. And increasingly part of just globalized Netflix culture, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. So there's no more ideological struggles, Sunni and Shia, extremism versus secularists. People just want money and power and to be consumers. So it's a little bit depressing from a leftist point of view, but they've suffered genocidal existential violence for so many years that I don't blame them.
Yeah, yeah, it's understandable. But so what about the sort of the non-state actors, the particularly the so-called Iranian-backed, you know, Shia paramilitary groups that were part of the Axis of Resistance, which has basically been dismantled now. Are they still active or have they gone pretty quiet?
So you have the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Forces, which mm-hmm. is a formal security body that was established to organize the various militias that had existed during the occupation, anti-Al-Qaeda and anti-American occupation militias. And then when ISIS took over several provinces and the security forces collapsed, you had just a mass mobilization of Iraqis from the south joining spontaneous militias. And by 2016, they formally created and legalized this body called the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Forces. But separate from that, you had four or five militias called the resistance forces, resistance factions rather, and they also fought ISIS. But then when things escalated with the Trump administration beginning in 2019 or so, they also engaged in tit-for-tat violence with the U.S. government, with U.S. Targets rather, mm-hmm. U.S. military. They hit the embassy a few times too. And then things got quiet by the time Biden won the elections. And then they would have stayed that way were it not for the post-October 7 wars, mm-hmm. where they joined the so-called unification of fronts to support battle for Gaza, but not to the extent that the Houthis and Lebanese Hezbollah did. So they did attack some American targets in Iraq and on the Jordanian border with Iraq. Some of their guys got killed and they backed down. They attacked American forces in northeast Syria a bit, but backed down because the priority for them is maintaining a stable Iraq. And then they kept on firing projectiles at Israel, I think only killing about three Israelis. And there was a period when they were actually firing like 5 to 10 projectiles a week, and the Americans were busy shooting those down because the Americans were worried that if the projectiles hit Israel successfully, Israel will retaliate against Iraqi targets, and then the Iraqis will hit American targets. And all that came to an end when the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon was announced about a year ago.
Right.
Although obviously that it's an Israeli style ceasefire, so it's a lower intensity war against Lebanon. Right. Anyway, the point is that they haven't engaged in anything since then because the Americans under Biden agreed to a gradual withdrawal of the anti-ISIS coalition and the return to bilateral relations. So as long as there is a fig leaf of respect for Iraqi sovereignty, it's unlikely that they're going to get involved in any military activity. There's a tendency towards preferring Iraqi stability over getting caught up in regional conflicts.
Right. So since I have you here, I'm curious what your take is right now on the possibility of a resumption of war with Iran, of Israel basically reigniting the war with Iran. There was definitely a lot of speculation about that in the months after that June war, that brief June war, that Israel would almost have to restart it. But now, I don't know, now it seems less to me from the outside, it seems less likely because it seems like Trump doesn't want it. And it seems like the Israelis are starting to be a little bit more sensitive to Trump's political needs because Israel has caused so much domestic political havoc. I don't know how much Trump is aware of it, but like his political handlers must be, you know, it's kind of fracturing MAGA. So I'm wondering what you think about the possibility of a resumption of war with Iran and what you know, and generally like how you see the ceasefire vis-a-vis Gaza going.
So I think even Trump is aware of it because he's made a few references to some changing attitudes among his base. And just a day or two ago, Marjorie Taylor Greene mm-hmm. responded to Trump calling her a traitor yeah. by suggesting that he's loyal to other countries. And I assume she's referring to Israel, which mm-hmm. is an increasing trend in the MAGA community. To yeah. the extent that I can follow these trends from far away in the Middle East. The Israelis do believe that they didn't succeed in achieving their goals and that Iran is busy rebuilding capabilities that the Israelis perceive as a threat. But they also know that they can't go to war without the Americans, mm-hmm. and the Americans don't want a war right now. So I do think that it's probably inevitable we'll have a round two. Not a regime change war, but just a conflict in which the Israelis will attempt to remove certain capabilities that the Iranians have that the Israelis disapprove of. The Iranians and their allies feel pretty good about the last war. Mm. The Iranian population that had been grumbling embraced the regime, and the regime has more support than it did before the war. Iran is a massive country, so they say it's easy for them to absorb mm-hmm. the damage. They believe, and their allies do, that they hit Israel effectively and successfully, and they showed they can do it by themselves without depending on their allies. Mm-hmm. And so they're also preparing for round two, and their allies in the region say that they've been getting Russian and Chinese weapons so that they mm-hmm. can correct the mistakes that were made in the past conflict. The Iranians also say that this was their first time basically putting into practice what was only theoretical. I mean, the Israelis and Americans are good at war because they're always at war.
Right.
For Iran, this is the first time really since the 1980s with mm-hmm. Iraq. So you're only good at it if you practice it. Mm-hmm. It's something the Russians are also learning the last
yes.
10 years. Yeah. So they think they'll do better next time. I suppose both sides are engaged in lessons learned and preparing for the next round.
Right. And it looks to you like the ceasefire in Gaza, such as it is, you know, I know it's, again, one of these Israeli ceasefires where we fire and you cease kind of thing, but it is still obviously a far, far lower level of murder in Gaza. Does it look to you like that's going to hold as well?
Likely, I think we'll maintain this lower intensity mm-hmm. Conflict where Israel can still achieve its goals of making life miserable for Palestinians and encouraging them to leave and just focus on day-to-day subsistence rather than on any political horizon.
Right.
And we've seen in Lebanon, they will increase the intensity and in Syria for that matter mm-hmm. to express displeasure, and they can do that in Gaza to a certain extent, although now they have American partners yeah. in Israel engaged in furthering the occupation. Mm-hmm. But that also limits the extent to which they can be genocidal.
Right. Real quickly, is there any latest with Hezbollah? I mean, I think you made the point, I would assume this probably still holds, that yes, Hezbollah was taken out of the war. The post-October 7th war, but they aren't but they're still there. Like they weren't defeated. Is that still holding? Like that they're still a force in Shia and Lebanese politics, that they still have, they still have war fighting capabilities right. within
They dominate politically and socially. Yeah, so politically and socially, they have a near monopoly on Shia support, and the war perhaps even increased that support a bit because Shias feel like there's a war against them.
Mm-hmm.
So that what used to be called the weapons of Hezbollah is increasingly seen by Shias as the weapons of Shias to defend their community from Israel, from Al-Qaeda just took over Syria and has a genocidal past and has already been massacring heterodox Muslims like Druze and Alawis since they took over. And even against Lebanese right-wing Christians who would love to see them crushed. And Shias feel a bit left out from the current government, which was formed largely by the Americans and the Saudis about a year ago. So the community certainly supports Hezbollah, although they've lost a revered father figure in Nasrallah, and he's difficult to replace. The military personnel are there. They lost a few thousand, but they're easy to replace, and training has been going on. But they've moved to a very different kind of organization. They're now, in a way, gone back to what they were in the 80s and 90s. They're underground, obviously, because they want to avoid getting hit.
Yeah.
So they're playing a cat and mouse game with the Israelis. They are rebuilding their military capabilities. The Israelis see some of that, and they hit some of that. They can still smuggle some stuff in from Syria, because Syria is in a state of chaos, and tribes in Syria are corrupt, and you can still smuggle things in. I guess it's in the... There's no moral comparison, but it's a bit like smuggling drugs. You expect that a certain amount will get caught, and then a certain amount will get through. The Americans and Israelis insist on Hezbollah disarming countrywide. That's never going to happen unless there's an invasion and an occupation, which is also not going to happen. The government came up with a plan to placate the Americans where they conditioned the disarming of Hezbollah on the Israeli withdrawal from the points it occupies in southern Lebanon and the cessation of Israeli military operations in Lebanon. That's never going to happen. So the government also kicked the can towards the army and asked the army to disarm Hezbollah. The commander of the army was like, fuck that. There's no way I'm going to drag the army into a civil war and have it break apart the way it did in the 70s and 80s. So we are going to stay at this point where Hezbollah is an underground movement that is trying to compensate its population for what they lost, paying for their rent, providing social services. But there's little reconstruction taking place in Lebanon because the so-called international community is holding Lebanon hostage, conditioning reconstruction, or even letting the Israelis even letting reconstruction take place in terms of allowing, not bombing bulldozers and construction equipment, conditioning that upon Hezbollah disarming. Hezbollah isn't going to disarm. Nobody's going to force them to disarm. Israel will continue bombing targets when it identifies them, obviously also often killing innocent people entirely unrelated to Hezbollah. And they have been gradually turning South Lebanon, especially the border towns, into flattened areas where any sign of past villages and towns doesn't exist anymore and people aren't returning. So they're achieving that strategic goal. And Hezbollah's in this quandary. What does it mean to be a resistance force or to engage in asymmetric warfare when your enemy has three advantages, if you can call them such? First of all, they have near godlike powers. When being in Lebanon during the war, it felt like War of the Worlds, like there's these aliens that could just step on you. And they're going to have to figure out a way to restore deterrence. And your enemy has no moral compunction to engage in genocidal violence. And Hezbollah didn't go all the way in this conflict because they feared Beirut turning into Gaza. And lastly, the American hand on the leash to restrain the rabid Israelis is no longer there for the first time. And so how do you restore deterrence? How do you make up for the technological gap? You can't return to 1960s, 70s, sort of 80s classic terrorist operations, because that won't achieve your goal. It'll just delegitimize you politically.
Right.
So now they're engaging in lessons learned and trying to figure out how to deal with the setback they suffered from what turns out to have been a strategic miscalculation when they joined in the conflict on October 8th, thinking they could pressure Israel to halt its operations against Gaza, and instead their country got sucked into this devastating war. It was certainly a humanitarian intervention par excellence and a just war, but it was also a strategic defeat for Hezbollah.
Yeah, that's grim and very helpful, and they're going to kind of have to go mainstream a bit, it seems like, you know, like in rock and roll terms or something, like to survive, because it is a different reality.
They're surrounded by enemies.
Yeah, they're surrounded by enemies.
Al-Qaeda basically controls Syria.
Didn't Tom Barrack say something to Shiraz Jolani? Something to the effect of, you know, we're going to work with Jolani, I think when he was out visiting, to dismantle Hamas and Hezbollah.
Luckily, the Syrian regime is a collection of militias that don't have the ability to even control all of Syria, let alone engage in operations against Lebanese targets. Nor does the Syrian regime, at least for now, want to expand outside of Syria. They're broke. Their army has been destroyed by the Israelis, they couldn't inherit the former Syrian army because Israelis destroyed all that. So it's effectively a militia that very sparsely controls territory in Syria. And they're not about to engage in that conflict, nor do their allies in Turkey and the Gulf want them to engage in that conflict. But it is a fear in the long term, because even if Jolani has become Ahmad al-Sharra and is no longer an ideological Salafi jihadist, the Syrian population is increasingly extremist. It's almost like ISIS became a popular movement. And it's very much a modern phenomenon, which I think can best be described as Sunni extremist fascism. But as a result, what you see in mosque sermons on Friday, in mosque religious classes after prayers, in schools every morning for kids, is the radicalization of an entire population, which is making people in Lebanon and Iraq, who are very sensitive to these things, which we can see on social media, very anxious. Now, Americans don't see that. Americans see a president wearing a suit, shaking hands with the whole world, saying all the right things about Israel and minorities and bullshit. But they don't see that the population is becoming radicalized in this very dangerous way, which even Iraqi Sunnis are uncomfortable, because they went through hell under ISIS and they don't want this to come back to them.
Right.
Certainly Iraqi Shias, Lebanese Shias, Lebanese Christians and Druze are very concerned about what's happening in Syria, as are maybe half the population in Syria, which isn't Sunni extremist. Likely we'll see much more fighting in Syria between various Sunni militias competing for power and resources and over ideological issues. And going after heterodox groups like Alawis, Druze, Shias, and perhaps eventually conflict with neighbors in Iraq and Lebanon as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think it's a good place to stop this part. Let's take a quick break and come back, and we will talk with Andreas Krieg about the United Arab Emirates. Okay, we're back, and very excited to have a guest today. His name is Andreas Krieg. He's a senior lecturer at the School of Security Studies at King's College London and a fellow at the Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. He has a great biography here. I'll just read off a few things. He's published extensively on strategic subversion, proxy warfare, weaponization of narratives, with a particular emphasis on Gulf security and geopolitical rivalry between regional actors in the Gulf. So this is all going to touch on stuff we've been very curious about on this show, and which keeps kind of coming up over and over in different topics. He's also the author of book Subversion and the author of a really fascinating article in Mediterranean Politics. The article, I'll post a link to it, is called Security Assistance to Surrogates, How the UAE Secures Its Regional Objectives. So first of all, Andreas, thanks for coming on Radio Warner.
Great pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, as I said, I think I said this to you in my first email reaching out to you. It's very hard to find, maybe we should talk about this a little later, but it's very hard to find a kind of holistic analysis of the UAE's larger strategy in sort of, the Horn, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean. You have this tiny country that has punched way above its weight and has been very involved. And, you know, you'll hear people getting angry about the UAE's role and back in the RSF and the RSF's sort of genocidal attacks in Darfur. And then you'll hear about the UAE running, sort of a gulag of torture camps in Yemen. And you'll hear about the UAE backing Abiy Ahmed in Ethiopia, where, we had violence and mass murder in Tigray. Like, so the UAE keeps popping up individually, but nobody's really, I don't know why, but nobody's really put it together to try to make sense from a military and a kind of strategic point of view, what the UAE, why they're doing and what they're doing in a holistic sense. So, as far as I could tell, you're one of the very only ones who's doing that. So first of all, congratulations.
Well, I'm not doing it holistically yet. I'm looking at different aspects of what they're doing. It's a very complex way of statecraft, very complex for a small state, very complex to understand. And, unfortunately, a lot of Gulf scholars who look at the UAE have been deterred from looking into the UAE because the UAE, obviously, a major funder
yes.
of academic programs
yes.
and think tanks. So, if your think tank is funded by the UAE, you don't really want to antagonize them. So
yes.
I think scholarship on the UAE is fairly limited, I would say.
Yes, exactly. I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you just came out and said it. And also media. And I guess because MBZ's father was the one that really started down the path of soft power influence. I mean, the UAE also has invested a lot in Washington and the whole Acela corridor, but certainly Washington lobbying, and I'm sure in London and Brussels as well. So I guess, first of all, let's kind of step back a bit and... because you do all this in a very clear way in your article. Give a brief background of the United Arab Emirates, because I don't think people even know sort of the brief history of the UAE, the seven Emirates, and then a brief background on who Mohammed bin Zayed MBZ is.
It's not a long history.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they came out of the Trucial States that used to be a British colony or protectorate in this part of the world until the 1970s, until 1971, developed into a federation of seven emirates that used to be fairly independent entities, into a federation of seven, which was, the capital was Abu Dhabi, but Dubai used to be the kind of the old sort of crown jewel of the Trucial States as a major hub for trade. But never really a major geopolitical player. And Abu Dhabi, the Al Nahyan, the royal family of Abu Dhabi, really over the last 50 years have kind of centralized power, consumed power, subverted power domestically as well, in, making the UAE really Abu Dhabi plus. Mostly to do with the fact that it's very oil rich. It's the wealthiest, the most populous emirate in the Emirates. But it's still a federation, after all, on paper, although one which is dominated by Abu Dhabi and thereby by the royal family of Abu Dhabi, which is the Al Nahyan. Mohammed bin Zayed has risen through the ranks of the military and the security sector of the last 25 whatnot years. And as you know, in this part of the world, they're all autocracies. Mm-hmm. The leadership, the personality of the leadership, the identity of the leadership really rubs off on the identity of the country. And I think MBZ has created a country in his own liking, if you will. So a lot of these approaches that the UAE have taken to statecraft is kind of a reflection of the personality of MBZ as someone who is Machiavellian. He is uncompromising. He is someone who likes to control. He's also someone who has a vision and is willing to push that through no matter what. And this no matter what element is very distinct for the UAE, very different from, let's say, Oman, Qatar, but even different from Saudi Arabia, where you have obviously strong leaders, but they're a bit more consensual in the way that they're trying to create statecraft and governance. In the UAE is very uncompromising. MBZ is very uncompromising. And so this individual who's, also a military man, has really left his mark on the Emirates and has created what used to be a federation. It's now basically a country run by Abu Dhabi, run by him and his brothers, the three brothers in particular, Mansour, Mohammed, and Tahnoun, who are called the Bani Fatima. They're basically brothers from a particular, from one mother or from one wife of Sheikh Zayed, who's the founder of the UAE. And his personality, his military and security-centric approach to redesigning the governance system in Abu Dhabi really defined who the UAE are today and has also defined their Machiavellian approach, their uncompromising approach to statecraft in the region.
Abu Dhabi became even more central after they bailed out the Dubai economy and arrogated even further power to themselves.
No, absolutely right. And so that has something to do with, obviously, with the wealth that Abu Dhabi has. With that wealth, and obviously the Northern Emirates being not socioeconomically not as fortunate as the south of the Emirates. So a lot of bailing out, a lot of money has come from Abu Dhabi, and where that money came always with strings attached. And it's true for statecraft as well. Abu Dhabi it's very interest focused. So when they do something, they don't do it altruistically. They do it in a Machiavellian sense of saying, everything is a quid pro quo. If we bail you out, we want something in return. And with Dubai, basically, Dubai had to surrender all aspects of statecraft that they used to have. They used to have their own police force, their own intelligence forces, their own military forces. Mm. They still have their own police forces, but in terms of intelligence and in terms of military, they've all been very centralized under the control of Abu Dhabi. And Dubai had to surrender that element of statecraft, and it's very much focused on business and trade only now.
Is there resentment from the other Emirates because of that?
Certainly, towards some policies. I think the Abraham Accords were, an Abu Dhabi project. In the Northern Emirates, you see a lot more sympathy for the Palestinian cause and people who would like to see the UAE using their special relationship with Israel for good, not just to kind of, use it for their own interest and advance the Palestinian cause. That's not in the interest of Abu Dhabi. And so there's been some dissent, and there's been some dissent also about the centralization of power, but nothing meaningful. I mean, the UAE holds a very tight grip on civil societal discourse and really controls what people say and also try to control what they think. Unlike any other country in the Gulf, I'd say in the UAE, civil society and freedom of speech is really constrained. And after all, I mean, the UAE, Abu Dhabi is delivering as well. I think it's not just authoritarian. It's also, delivering public goods to keep people quiet. It's a little bit like bread and circuses. They've really been able to redirect public discourse away from social and political issues towards issues such as entertainment, fun, stuff you see on social media, sports and that sort of stuff.
Quite literally, bread and circus in the Roman sense, because they have really been massive promoters of MMA, UFC, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yes.
Right. So can you tell me a bit more about Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ's military background? Because one doesn't normally think, when one thinks of Gulf aristocrats, one doesn't usually think of military, you know. But he's obviously very serious about it. So what is his military background?
Yeah, so I mean, he was one of the sons of Zeit, not the oldest one. He, you know, they usually, in all royal families, you have some who go into the security sector or the military, and he was chosen to be that guy. He was also someone, had probably more humble background or humble upbringing in comparison to some other brothers or sons and of Zayed. You know, he lived for a while in fairly, yes, people say it's Spartan conditions in Morocco. But he certainly was always, you know, he went to Sandhurst here in the UK, the military academy, which is tough to go through. And, you know, he was a good student. He was, you know, he was always a very well-respected, very ambitious, hardworking, and people say quite humble guy in this context. I mean, he very much a military sort of mindset. And he rose through the ranks, became chief of staff under his brother. And, you know, his background, his immediate network within Abu Dhabi was one that has come out of the security sector, particularly out of the military. And you see that a lot of people who were appointed in the technocracy that's Abu Dhabi today have a background from the military as well, because that's what MBZ feels comfortable with.
So he's less of a kind of like sovereign wealth fund, you know, that type of leader?
No, that's his brother. Oh, both of the brothers. So Mansour and also Tahnoun are more of the economic statecraft, financial statecraft kind of people. That's not Mohammed bin Zayed.
I see. Okay. That's interesting. So what sort of, what is the UAE's military force? I guess, you know, starting, let's say if we go back to... you pinpointed, and I thought that was really interesting because I hadn't thought about that, you know, that the Libya intervention was really the kind of the catalyst to start the UAE's more kinetic imperial drive. But what does their military consist of?
Mohammed bin Zayed, again, very ambitious. His domain at the time was the military. So, you know, for him to control and, you know, make a name, brand himself, he needed to make a name for himself in the military. So he reorganized the military, I would say, it's probably the most efficient armed forces in the Gulf. You know, among the blind people, the one-eyed are the kings, so to speak. And, you know, it's a fairly efficient, fairly slim, agile military by Gulf standards. And they started early on already to, you know, deploy special forces in the Balkans. They supported US operations in Afghanistan. So they were a, you know, what the Americans would call a near peer military in some of these operations. They've proven themselves. And it became very quickly a tool of statecraft where, you know, traditionally the Gulf states were not, they looked at their military as a way to defend themselves. But it was also a nepotistic way of kind of keeping people employed and, you know, creating usually a tool for regime security. But here they used it in an expeditionary way. So the military in the UAE always had, not always, but over the last 20 years, had a more of an expeditionary sort of component. And then the Arab Spring came. And 2011 is really one of the catalysts where the Emiratis wanted to push back against, you know, the Arab revolutions, wanted to clamp down, and used the military as a way in 2011, together with the Qataris, to offer the UK and the US a force multiplying role as Arab states in the fight against Gaddafi in Libya. And so that was in 2011. And
that's,
it was fairly successful in terms of what they were bringing to the table and the way they integrated with other NATO countries. And that's, you know, from that time onwards, they really saw the military as a tool that could be used in an expeditionary way. And you might have read about the UAE or Abu Dhabi being referred to as Little Sparta, which kind of comes out of that period of saying, okay, they're very different from other Gulf states. They're quite willing to use the military. And I think 2015, the intervention in Yemen is another sort of milestone for them, where they had this amphibious landing in Aden, which is a very sophisticated sort of operation to orchestrate, to conduct. And they did a fairly good job in doing this, in capturing Aden, and doing so in a way that most people would have thought a Gulf military was not able to do it. And so Yemen was another catalyst, obviously also in a negative way, because they had a lot of casualties. And then they had a slight change of heart in terms of, you know, for the first time they had quite considerable costs in terms of casualties. And then they had to reconsider whether these sort of wars of choice are really, if they really want to get into that, and whether they want to sacrifice their own blood and treasure to do so.
Just a few statistics for listeners here on the UAE, and correct me if, tell me if this sounds roughly correct. Total population of 11 million, but roughly 10% of that are native Emiratis, and the overwhelming majority of the expats or migrant workers are from South Asia.
Yeah.
Does that sound right? Yeah. So yes. it's like a much larger version of Qatar in that sense. Size, it's a much larger than some of the other, I mean, aside, of course, it's much larger than Qatar, let's say. It's 32,000 square miles. So that's roughly the size of the state of South Carolina. And it has the sixth largest proven reserves of oil and natural gas globally. So it's still just a major oil and gas exporter. That's where it gets most of its revenues. Is that right?
Yes.
And then gold, of course. Gold and
but they don't have any domestic gold. I mean, yes, right. Dubai is a gold hub, but that's because they've built these global networks to kind of redirect flows of gold and diamonds into, you know, making Dubai a commodity trading hub.
Right. And is it fair to say it's also like a kind of a Switzerland? It's a banking center as well.
Nobody would ever refer to the UAE as a Switzerland of the Middle East, because Switzerland, you know, what people talk about when they talk about Switzerland is being neutral, being a mediator, being a broker.
Right.
That certainly isn't Abu Dhabi. I mean, they're a financial hub. Dubai is a financial hub globally, but definitely in the region. That's where a lot of these strings, financial flows, kind of come together.
Yes.
But they're, you know, when people speak about the Switzerland of the Middle East, they usually speak about Qatar or Oman because they're kind of neutral mediators. While Abu Dhabi is all but that.
Right. Right.
You're right in a sense, in that they filled a vacuum with the collapse of the Lebanese banking sector. In that,
right?
If you want to hide dirty money, if you're the former Afghan elite under the American occupation, if you're a Syrian Captagon dealer or a former Syrian regime elite, or even Yemeni elites, the safest place for you to put your money is in the UAE because it's an American ally, so they won't go after your money or after the banks the way they do in Iraq or Lebanon.
That's true. But it has purposefully, I mean, we might be able to talk about it later on, but it's been part of their model of statecraft. You want to attract also dirty money, and it's a lot of, you know, large crime syndicates, you know, from the Chinese over the Russians to, you know, any sort of Arab organized crime. Iranian dirty money and smuggled money, Russian smuggled money, you know, any sort of anyone who wants to launder bitcoins, crypto, if you want to launder drug money, you want to launder commodity money and translate that into, you know, cash that you can use for other things. Dubai allowed this to happen, or the UAE allowed this to happen. So the jurisdiction has been open to these sort of dealings because it gives you influence, because it, you know, and, you know, I don't want to single out Dubai here. I mean, London has a very bad reputation as well. Wherever there are financial hubs, there are, you know, sort of things going on in that respect. But I think Dubai and the UAE very purposefully used this as a business model. And so far it hasn't backfired, and it has given them immense leverage and strategic depth with different sort of networks, especially in the global south.
Yeah, that's a great point. So let's go back to Libya and maybe just dig in just a little bit more to the Libya intervention. Because, you know, the West, at least, NATO, their goal was to get rid of Gaddafi, and they sort of lost interest once the state was broken, except insofar as it became a transit point for migrants to go to Europe or something. And then, of course, you know, extremist Islamists were another issue. But in terms of creating the state, they sort of left it to other actors, and the UAE wound up, so I guess Turkey and Qatar became more backers of the Tripoli government, and UAE eventually gravitated towards Haftar, who has a bad reputation in the West, but he's more identified with Wagner Group and Russian assistance. I don't even know how much Russia's still backing them, but that's at least how he's been written up in much of the Western press, or at least the American press. Can you talk about how the UAE, what their role is, how they kind of developed them? Because it seems like they sort of like learned and adapted and then applied to other areas what they learned in sort of developing Haftar.
Haftar only appears on the scene in 2014. Mm-hmm. So between 2011, the fall of the Gaddafi regime, Gaddafi gets killed in September 2011, we have a transitional process of governance. Obviously, a country that was under for four decades under an authoritarian dictatorship doesn't smoothly transition to democracy. And whether we want to transition to democracy or not is a different, a story in itself, and whether this was even ever achievable, but to some sort of representative governance. And that transition process, was slow. It had a couple of hiccups. And the UAE were really developed a phobia since 9/11, but particularly during the Arab Spring, a phobia of political Islam, phobia of civil society. They saw the Arab Spring as an uprising of the Arab people against the old ancien regime, if you will, the old authoritarians. And obviously they themselves, they're a tribal monarchy. They immediately, what happened in Syria, Libya, Tunisia, Egypt, and in Bahrain and Yemen, immediately came home or was perceived as a threat, not as an opportunity, a threat to regime security. So they were really uneasy about what was happening in Libya between 2011 and 2013, 2014, when we see this transition of government where Islamists were part of the elected government, were part of the transitional process. And it happened in a vacuum. I mean, that was the Obama years. Obama mm-hmm. had basically withdrawn, or the United States had started to withdraw from the region after Iraq. And they left, and the perception in the Gulf was the region was left to its own devices. And the UAE said, we can't leave it to its own devices. We need to manage that. And so this activism that we saw, I mean, again, pivotal moment was in Libya. It was Egypt 2013, when they backed the military-led coup to get Sisi, for Sisi to basically seize an opportunity to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood government. Mm-hmm. And doing so, exploiting what was a popular mobilization, which the Emiratis were fueling to create a pretext for the military and the military intelligence to exploit to create this coup that then get Sisi into power. That was the first strike, let's put it that way, from the Emiratis in an effort to change the direction and the cause of regional history in terms of saying, the Arab Spring is failing. We can't control it. We want to return to stability. And for them, they call it authoritarian stability. The idea is stability in the Middle East can only be achieved when you have one man with a strong hand, an iron fist, able to keep a lid on the socio-political mobilization. And that's kind of what happened in Egypt 2013. And then half a year later, a bit more than that, in February 2014, you had this old, at the time he wasn't a warlord, he was a sort of a former Gaddafi official, and I think his rank was field marshal or something like that, Khalifa Haftar, who started to appear on the scene. He used to be in a CIA asset as well mm-hmm. for a long time. I think he even holds an American citizenship. And
right, he appeared lived in Virginia for a while, didn't he? Or,
yeah, he did. And he used to work for the CIA, so that's all very well documented. Right. But he appeared on a very random sort of YouTube video on the 14th of February, 2014, a kind of, how would we call it, the Valentine's Day coup. Yeah. Not much happened. Nobody took notice. And he was basically calling for the overthrow of this transitional government. And nobody noticed him, but the Emiratis noticed him. So we see a professionalization of this sort of dissident or coup-like revisionist approach and narrative from February to, I think it was in May, June 2014, where he reappeared and called it He called it the Operation Dignity, to basically take back the country from, these, what he called Islamists and terrorists and whatnot. And between this February and June 2014, the Emiratis invest heavily in PR, in kind of making sure that the way he's presenting himself is, he's reaching the right people, the way that, it wasn't a kind of improvised YouTube video, but it was very formalized. The operation had a name. The LNA that he built around himself, these brigades, these militias, they would be funded, they'd be trained, they'd get military support. And so this Operation Dignity in June, in the summer of 2013 in Libya, really became a force in its own right with an attempt to overthrow this this transitional process.
I'm sorry to interrupt. So the UAE sent in military advisors, PR experts, and so on. And these are Emirati citizens, or are these hirelings from the UAE? To create
there's a lot of special forces that appear on the ground that do some of the training and organization of what later became the so-called Libyan National Army. Mm-hmm. But they're militias and sort of brigades at that point. Some of them leftovers from that revolutionary civil war in 2011, 2012. Mm-hmm. And so that formalization, the integration of these into a kind of loose network of different brigades, all that's done by the military, the Emirati military. Some of the logistical support is done via companies. The UAE, after all, you mentioned it's a country of a million people. It's not a million citizens. So if you don't have the bandwidth to feed a military, their military is 60,000 and above troops. So per capita for a country of a million citizens, having 60,000 people in arms is crazy. So a lot of them are obviously loan service as well as mercenary forces. They come from other parts of the world. But the special forces, usually they are Emiratis. And there were a lot of Emiratis on the ground in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I think, could we talk briefly about this ideological divide? Because another kind of running theme that we've come across in the show, talking about different theaters, is this kind of ideological rivalry between, and well, you mentioned it, I think, in as well, between, I guess you'd roughly say, between the UAE on one side, which is more realpolitik, Gulf ideology, and Qatar, which is seen as more Muslim Brotherhood. They are a sponsor of Muslim Brotherhood and more, I guess, Islamist friendly, but also progressive in another face of Qatar. And I'm sure there are all kinds of leaks through this, you know, there are all kinds of variations within this. But and then the Saudis, I think, have generally been seen as much more as allies with the UAE, although that breaks down as well. But what can you say? How much is this ideological rivalry a real thing?
Yeah, I mean, the very simplistic reasoning or framing of this has been, okay, here's the Emiratis who, and that's how they perceive themselves. We're fighting political Islam. We're a secular country. Obviously, they're not, but they're pretending to be a country where there's a division between mosque and state. And on the other hand, you've got Turkey and Qatar, where who feel quite comfortable around political Islam as well. But obviously, the AK Party in Turkey is an Islamic, maybe even Islamist party. Mm-hmm. Qatar is not an Islamist country. It's a tribal monarchy. Again, very small state. They've been open to all kinds of factions. The Qataris and the Emiratis have diametrically opposed strategic cultures in terms of how they look at the world. The UAE, Abu Dhabi in particular, they look at the region and they look at the world through a lens of threat. The Qataris usually look at the world through a lens of opportunity, seeing, okay, what can be done. And the previous emir, Father Emir in Qatar, he was someone who was seeing an opportunity in 2011 of maybe changing the region, because it was changing anyway, of kind of, you know, channeling these changes into a political transition away from authoritarianism to maybe not democracy, but some sort of people-led governance. Not very strategic. The Qataris initially very successful in 2011-12, but then by 2013, they're realizing, you know, we are too small to sustain this. It's going into different directions. The Saudis initially support the Qataris, particularly in Syria, and the Emiratis don't do anything until 2013, until Egypt, and they are seeing this as a fundamental threat. And so the Qataris back down in 2013, and there's this change of government handover to the current Emir Tamim. But there's no support in this way. You know, there's always the idea of them supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. They supported the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But when it came to all these other civil societal and Islamist groups, they're very loosely, if ever, related to the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's much bigger than that. But the Qataris, as I say, they look at these things as opportunities. They have the luxury of being the richest country in the world, very small community, no internal rifts, no internal insecurities, no internal complexes, if you will. And then you have Abu Dhabi in the UAE, which is a federation. There's a lot of friction between different emirates, different royal families. There's friction within the royal families. There are socioeconomic divides from the north to the south. You have in the UAE a political Islamic party that you never had in Qatar. I mean, there's the Al-Islah party, which is an offshoot, if you will, of the Muslim Brotherhood. So this whole political Islam for the UAE was never an opportunity. It was always a threat. And there was a lot of fertile ground for them to potentially succeed domestically. And I think that's fundamentally different from how the Qataris have been looking at the Arab Spring and political Islam and whatnot. And that divide for a long time, obviously we had that blockade of Qatar in 2017 until 2021 that the UAE led. That divide over narratives, over philosophy, over vision for the region somewhat still persists. But I think we're now in a much more pragmatic moment where the Gulf states are rallying around the flag because they're saying we've got bigger problems now You know, to one hand, we've got Iran, and on the other hand, we've got Israel. So we need to kind of stick together now. But fundamentally, there's a philosophical divide over where the region should be going.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the Yemen. And I know you've mentioned it, but I'd like to talk a little bit more about it because it also transformed the UAE's military sort of strategy. First of all, I guess, why did the UAE intervene? And if I'm not mistaken, they intervened with Saudi Arabia and initially Qatar, although Qatar backed out pretty quickly. So why did they intervene and how did their intervention evolve?
Yemen has been insecure for a while, but the Arab Spring hit Yemen as well. There was a lot of social mobilization against Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was the dictator at the time. You have various divides between, you know, northerners and southerners, between those who live in the highlands and those who live in coastal areas. They've got the Hadramaut, you've got, you know, they get the Houthi Shia factions, you've got the Sunni factions, you've got the Islamist factions. It's a highly divided country, very similar to Afghanistan, loads of tribal divisions as well. And all of this came to the forefront after 2011 and 12. There was a national dialogue that failed. In 2014, in all that chaos, the Houthis seized control of Sana'a, the capital, and they're really, you know, sending shockwaves around Arabia, because obviously Houthis being at this point being financed partially by Iran. So, you know, the arch enemy of most of the Gulf states. And so the Saudis decide in 2015, in March, with a new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman at the time, new crown prince who was the new defense minister, said, okay, I want to make a name for myself. We're going to remove the Houthis from Sana'a and we use our military might together with the rest of the GCC. They entered a war that was unwinnable. It never had a strategic endgame that was actually achievable, obviously largely an air power campaign. But in the end, it was a campaign that the Saudis were left to their own devices fighting inside Yemen, while the Emiratis, for the most part, were fighting in the south in areas that are more relevant for Emirati national interests. And, you know, around coastal areas, around Aden, they didn't fight the Houthis very much. They were mostly down in the south. But as I mentioned before, they were struck by a missile, a Houthi missile in, I think, September 2015. In one day, 52 Emirati soldiers were killed. The single biggest traumatic experience for the armed forces in the UAE, which kind of led to a sea change in the way that they are approaching Yemen, where from then on, they kind of delegated war fighting to local actors and to mercenaries. Mm-hmm. But it was a divide where the Saudis were fighting in the north and the Emiratis were fighting in the south, mostly against different Islamist factions, different factions that were kind of disrupting the fabric of the southern movement, which was a secessionist movement that has been around for a while since, you know, Yemen reunited in 1990. Mm-hmm. And so the Emiratis became, you know, they were fighting their own war in Yemen, which was very different from the Saudi-led war in the north.
If I can just add also the Emirati fear of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a common theme throughout their interventions, was also a factor in Yemen, where the Islah Party, which is the Muslim Brotherhood Party, has a major support. And the Saudis have aligned with Islah, but the Yemenis supported the Southerners in part because the Southerners hate the Muslim Brotherhood. But they also had a very self-interested approach that had almost nothing to do with the internal conflict in Yemen and more to do with their three-shore, three-coast policy of security, where they view the west coast and the southern coast of Yemen as important for their strategy, which they would describe as keeping maritime security safe. So they want all three shores of the Arabian Peninsula, the Red Sea, the Gulf, the Arabian Sea, to be under their control. So they have bases in this island called Pirim in Bab al-Mandab and in Socotra.
Socotra, they took it over, basically, Socotra, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And it goes to show that, obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood thing is a real phobia. This is a real ideological, philosophical threat to them. But it's also a pretext to do other things, to secure, you know, trade routes and, you know, maritime channels and passages and so on. And so the way that they've built this little island war that they've done around the southern coast of Yemen isn't about the Muslim Brotherhood. It's really about strategic depth and interest.
That sort of ideology, let's say, like anti-communism, was an organizing ideology in the Cold War that provided, I don't know, an idea that gave purpose to a lot of you know, I don't know, imperialism or whatever you call it by the U.S. Like it is an organizing principle, anti-Muslim Brotherhood. It seems to be a little bit like how anti-communism kind of worked during the Cold War. So from there, let's look at the Red Sea and the UAE's role in the Horn of Africa. I mentioned it briefly earlier. In Ethiopia, they came to Abiy Ahmed's defense when the TPLF broke out of Tigray and was marching towards Addis Ababa. And seemed to play up
together with Iran and Turkey. So
yeah,
Turkey. It was strange bedfellows in that conflict.
Right, right. And so they had a hand in what turned out to be really a genocide or genocidal acts in Tigray. I mean, 600,000 to 1 million people killed. Somalia. It looks like the UAE has been basically. I mean, they're involved deep there, but if I understand it right, they've kind of played a role of backing Puntland or Somaliland, kind of helping break the country up. And in fact, that seems to be, and you write about this in your paper, that seems to be one of their, I don't know, that seems to be part of their global statecraft, which is breaking countries up to gain influence. Can you talk about that a bit?
So I call it the axis of secessionist. You know, we talk about the Iranian axis of resistance. Mm. Again, non-state actors, network of different non-state actors who are locally embedded in the local community and are all somewhat tied back into Iran. Some of it obviously being degraded by Israel over the last last 2 years. The UAE have created their own axis, starting from Libya with the LNA and Haftar. In Yemen, they built the STC as a framework that kind of is exploiting or even subverting the southern cause into a quasi-state actor that competes with the northern government and competes with the Houthis, but actually doesn't want to integrate into, it's not about creating an independent Yemen, it's about creating an independent southern Yemen or a south Yemen. And so the very clear secessionist cause in, obviously the LNA in Libya for a long time was trying to take over Tripoli. They've tried tried twice and they failed. And now they've basically kind of dug in eastern Libya, and they probably arguably hold the most, you know, sizable and also the most important part of Libya. And so that for the UAE is important enough that they hold control over the most important element of multipolar sort of conflicts, and they kind of control the most important hub there. And in Somalia, they always had a relationship with Mogadishu, but they had its ups and downs. But they were really strategically, since 2010, investing in Puntland, Somaliland, and also as of late in Jubaland, which is another province or another state of Somalia. And so that Federation of Somalia, there are a lot of secessionist movements anyway. Mm-hmm. And again, the UAE embed, they usually, again, it's a militia group, usually a group that is armed, a violent non-state actor that is embedded within a secessionist cause on the ground that is able to, you know, becomes entirely codependent on the UAE, which is able to give the UAE access to strategic sort of choke points or important access to trade corridors. And that kind of is a pattern that we're seeing happening first in Libya, then in Yemen, then in Somalia, with particularly Puntland and Somaliland, and now Jubaland. And as of late, obviously over the last 4 years, but you know, you can go back to 2013 or even before that, also with the RSF in Darfur and in Sudan. And so you've got now four countries where the secessionist causes were ripened, exploited, and advanced by the UAE to advance their geostrategic interest.
Is it working for in UAE's favor, just taking it on their own Machiavellian realpolitik terms? I mean, there would presumably be downsides to this, and presumably upsides too. Because I have another dumb question, which is, why do they need to control this? Why not just ship your oil and gas without having to play all these risk, you know, board games with these countries?
I mean, shipping oil and gas is not a long-term strategy. It's not a grand strategy in itself. And it pays, for the moment, it still pays the bills, but diversification is extremely important. So the UAE is very successful in diversifying its economy and reinvesting the revenues or the profits of its oil trade, energy trade, into alternative, you know, private sectors, whether it's AI or new energy and tech and, you know, financial services and logistics. But it's also about becoming a hub, because they don't want to be, and that's very different to other small states in the Gulf. The self-perception of Abu Dhabi is not one of, they're not quite comfortable with being a small state. They don't want to be perceived as a small state. They do aspire to be a middle power. And arguably, I think they've achieved that status of being a middle power. They are, particularly in Africa, Horn of Africa and the Middle East, they are a middle power on par with France, Germany, the UK, and at times even working against US interest, and quite confidently so, because they have more leverage in certain countries than the United States. I mean, when it comes to Libya or Yemen and also Sudan, I don't think the United States, despite the fact that they, you know, might be a superpower in decline, but they're still, you know, the biggest power in the world, are unable to do what the Emiratis can do, because they're more agile, they're more broadly, they have more bandwidth that they can use, they have more contacts on all sides, on various sides of the conflicts. So that gives them strategic depth and influence that outperforms any other state in the Middle East, including Israel, but also any most of the middle powers of the West. And so that is why they're doing it. And they've been able to get away with it because, you know, they've made themselves, and that's part of the strategy, they made themselves irreplaceable. And as such, that's kind of what they always wanted to achieve. They wanted to become a power that you cannot do without. And that's true in all of these crises. We might not like what the UAE are doing. We don't like how they're doing it. But then there's an argument to be made that you can't avoid them because they're already there. You know, that's what I call weaponized interdependence. They've created a web that is so all-encompassing that there's whatever way you want to go in any of these conflicts, you'll have to eventually speak to the Emirates. And that means you can't just ignore them as just another small state. And that's a status that they've created for themselves at a reputational cost, particularly with local communities hate them. I mean, there's a big group in Somalia, you know, if you go to social media, who are anti-Emirati because they're saying the Emiratis are taking over, subverting our country. Obviously, massive mobilization in Sudan against them, mobilization in Yemen against them, mobilization in North African countries as well against them, because they are so uncompromising. But none of this really affects the ability for the UAE to exploit the interdependence that they have created.
And they don't get punished. Yeah. The first example was in 2014 when the Emiratis, I mean, thanks to their coup in Egypt, they were able to obtain bases in Egypt, which they then used to bomb Libya in the summer of 2014 without coordinating with the U.S., seemingly even in defiance of Obama-era preferences. Nobody even knew who did it until September of 2014. And the U.S. wasn't happy about it but couldn't do anything about it, because if you reproach them they could just say, effectively, the bargain was never established, the terms of the bargain, so they can just be like, what are you going to do about it? And then the U.S. would be like, we can't do anything about it. They've been able to operate beyond reproach, maybe from the U.S., even more than Israel. But it just a point on the Horn of Africa, which is often overlooked because it's not sexy at all, is the fact that the UAE and other Gulf countries depend on the Horn of Africa for food so much. So there's a more classic imperialist relationship, in a sense that harkens back to maybe the Europeans, a century or more ago, because the Gulf has exploded its population since the 1970s to today, from like 10 million to 60 million if you include all the expats. And the Horn of Africa is one of the largest exporters of livestock, and the Gulf is in a state of of chronic food insecurity. And they have to find a way to feed their population. So they've been buying up agricultural land in the Horn of Africa, but at least as important, depend on Sudan and Somalia for meat. And that dependency on meat has fueled conflicts in Somalia and Sudan in a fascinating way, because of they therefore have to support the an industrial kind of a farm production and displacing populations who are then herded into refugee camps or militias. So much of the conflicts, especially in Sudan, have an element of this imperialist displacement of the population, both for mining resources, but at least as importantly for agricultural and sheep-producing resources.
That's a great point. That's a great point, because usually we hear more about the UAE's gold interest, basically, across the Sahel, which is also not small. I mean, the UAE's even played a role in conflicts in Mali and Burkina Faso and stuff, because of the gold.
It's not only that it's not sexy. I think what gold does, what commodities does, or commodities do in comparison to livestock and farmland, which is obviously extremely important for food security in the Gulf, is that you, with gold and commodities, you get direct access to the sort of nepotistic regimes, these patrimonial regimes and those networks around those in power, because they all have a sort of, you know, due to the corruption in many of these countries, you have, if you have control over the gold trade, then yes, most of the time the elites who are involved in it also have political power. So it's something that gives you straight, very deep, influential access to these kind of sources and networks of power in these countries.
Yeah, that's a great point. Quick question, because I worked for many years in Russia, and I know a lot of Russians who moved to the UAE and know about a lot of Russians who moved to the UAE. I mean, the Russians are in very deep with the UAE, which is yep, so interesting, because the UAE is also, you know, a close ally of the U.S., the Abraham Accords. I was going to ask you why you think they signed the Abraham Accords, but I think it's almost kind of obvious. I mean, it gives them another layer of kind of get out of jail free card with the U.S.
It's not about Israel and it's not about Palestine. It's literally a way of, how do you tap into the pro-Israel lobby in the United States? And I think it's probably, from that point of view alone, the Abraham Accords are a massive success, because the UAE are using this every single time, you know, with congressmen or staffers or anyone in the U.S. that, you know, whenever we say, oh, look, they're, you know, they're, because one thing is the Russian exposure. I mean, they're the main enabler for Russia and Wagner Group and what is now Africa across the African continent. They wouldn't have been able to exist in Africa without the UAE and using their jurisdiction.
Right.
But also they're very crucial for Chinese interests as well. I mean, in the AI tech sector, the UAE have invested massively, joint ventures with Chinese companies. There are Chinese companies in the ecosystem, the AI and tech ecosystem in the UAE. And so the UAE are trying to get from both sides. They're not aligned with the West in any way. You can make a strong case, especially now that MBS was in Washington. It's quite clear that the United States, that the Saudis are invested primarily in the United States. Mm-hmm. Qatar, I'd say, is probably the 51st U.S. state, if you will. They're so aligned, couldn't get any more aligned. The Emiratis are not aligned in that way. They're very Machiavellian. When it serves them, they're aligned with the U.S. When they see interest somewhere else, they align with the Chinese or the Russians. But because they have that relationship with Israel, it's an out-of-jail card. Every single time, crises come up or conflicts come up or conflict of interest come up, there's always someone saying, yeah, you know, I don't like what the UAE are doing, but they are the ones who normalized with Israel.
They're actually desperate to be seen as useful for Israel under Bashar al-Assad, Syria. The Emiratis never cut off ties, but they formally reestablished ties in 2018. And they were sending emissaries, and they were desperate to mediate between the Assad regime and the Israelis, thinking that this would make them look good to the West. So it's kind of like a reverse anti-Semitism. They think that Jews are so powerful that that if you get them to like you, this will help you in Washington.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, this is actually a good point. It's a reverse anti-Semitism, because they do believe in these anti-Semitic tropes of, you know, they rule the country. So we need to tap into these networks. It's a good point.
Yeah. Cyrus, could you add, since you brought it up earlier, can you say a few words about what the Emiratis have been up to in Iraq and see how this fits into what we've been talking about?
So none of the Gulf countries were happy with what happened in 2003. This is, maybe some of them were happy with Saddam being removed, but then they saw that it's going to be a Shia-led country if it's any kind of democracy. And into the vacuum that the Americans created were also forces close to Iran. And so they panicked and started supporting, even back then, various insurgent forces. The Qataris, Emiratis, Saudis would finance various Sunni extremist militias that fought the Americans and the Shias. But they also then financed political parties. So Ayad Alawi's Iraqiya party, Ayad Alawi being the first prime minister of Iraq, he was appointed, not elected, was massively backed by the Emiratis, because he was, despite being Shia, he's secular, had Sunnis in his parties, former Ba'athist, And actually kind of like the Iraqi Haftar, also ex-CIA guy. Mm. And so they supported his campaigns in 2006 and 2010. He lost both times to Maliki, mm-hmm. Nouri al-Maliki, who was basically also America's man, but more of a conservative Shia. And then when the Arab Spring started and Gulf countries thought that they could ride the Sunni wave to undo this historic injustice of having a Shia prime minister in Iraq, kind of like the historic injustice of having a black president in the U.S. when Obama took over, at least the way that some white people saw it. And anyway, the Emiratis, Qataris, and Saudis began to finance what were called the military councils. So there were protests, squares in various Sunni provinces and towns, and money was secretly funneled to ex-insurgent Ba'athist tribal leaders, a little bit Sunni extremists. A lot of the money was actually stolen by the people that were supposed to deliver it.
Yeah,
but
happens.
Anyway, the Qataris and the Emiratis basically financed the armed groups that took over these provinces, created chaos in a vacuum, which allowed ISIS to take over. So they're directly implicated in the rise of ISIS in Iraq by facilitating that vacuum. Mm. And then when ISIS blew up in everybody's face and nobody wanted to use Sunni extremist factions to change the system, the Emiratis adopted a guy called Halbousi, who was governor of, he was a member of parliament, a young, energetic guy, secular, non-ideological, just a corrupt sort of gambler, who was a member of parliament, then became governor of Anbar, and then speaker of parliament. And they would finance his campaign, his party, hundreds of millions of dollars every campaign. And he became the most powerful Sunni politician with the largest Sunni party in Iraq. He's so financially independent that this year they basically didn't have to get involved. And they also shifted their policies. They supported Muqtada Sadr 4 years ago when he was trying to single-handedly represent the Shias in Iraq. And when that blew up in their face, they, in part after Iraqis and Houthis fired drones at the UAE, very much a result of that, they quickly shifted their policy and started meeting with Asaib al-Haq, which was a former anti-American, anti-Al-Qaeda militia that then became a political party, considered terrorist by the U.S., but a very successful Shia political movement. They began to strike business relationships with those guys in order to secure the UAE from being hit any further, and encouraging their Sunni partners to be more cooperative as well. In the current elections, they basically weren't involved for the first time, but their partners have become the dominant Sunni player in Iraq. And typical UAE, it's non-Islamist, non-ideological political parties. So not dangerous compared from an Iraqi Shia point of view, compared to more Sunni sectarian figures.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think we do see a pattern, and correct me if I'm wrong, Andres, what you think, but they are pretty successful. I mean, you know, as you keep saying, they punch way above their weight. It is remarkable that a country, I mean, really a country of 1 million, is a peer in a very important strategic region. So I mean,
I can just interrupt.
Yeah,
I actually completely disagree with you that they're successful.
Yeah, okay.
I think they've been a cancer throughout everywhere where they've intervened. But where are they? In Libya, they ended up completely abandoning their former policy. The Turks are now have a good relationship with the Haftars. The Turks helped defeat the UAE-backed forces. And the Emiratis ended up facilitating both sides in the Libyan conflict, achieving a rapprochement. In Yemen, they've been able to help destroy Yemen, but Houthis control most of the country. They haven't achieved the goal of changing Yemen. They've achieved the goal of destroying it enough that maybe some of their concerns are addressed and they're able to occupy certain areas for their ports.
They don't control Al-Bab. That's true. The Al-Bab Straits. So
they've destroyed Sudan, but their guy is. I mean, the RSF is hated universally. Is viewed as the more bad guy than both of the bad guys fighting the conflict, and is unlikely to actually. They were effectively their progress was halted. They aren't defeated, but they're not going to win the conflict in Sudan. So they.
It really depends on how you measure victory.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, this is an interesting point.
Yeah.
First of all, I would say, because we look at small, I don't like the small states literature and the idea that some states are small and some are big and that's why they have a different approach to foreign and security policy. That's very 20th century. That's very state-centric realism. The reality today, the way I look at the world, is more network-centric anyway. And I do think that's kind of, if you look at the region particular as a network, because states don't matter that much. They might be primus inter pares, but these jurisdictions are all penetrated. They don't have territorial control. They don't have full sovereignty. It's a lot of non-state actors, sub-state actors that run the show. High net worth individuals who work together with some governments run the show. It's, you know, militant, violent non-state actors, corporations, logistics companies, commodity trading companies, financiers. They are the ones who run the show in the background, really. If you look at the world in that way, if you look at the region in that way, then the idea of smallness doesn't really matter, because it doesn't matter what your territory is, doesn't matter what your GDP is, it doesn't matter, even population doesn't matter, because you can delegate things to networks if you know how to exploit them. And so I just finished writing a book which is kind of called, Webs of Power, the weaponization of networks, a network-centric statecraft. It's how you exploit these networks for your own liking. And the Emirates are extremely successful in that. The thing with networks, though, is if you orchestrate them, you curate them, they will never deliver clear-cut victory. So a network will never be able to win you a world war. They would never be there to you, because, you know, kinetic power usually traditionally has been about concentration of force. And the Emiratis are not about concentration of force. They're about decentralization of force, which is very counter Clausewitzian, if you will. Spreading your wings, spreading your networks, decentralizing, but then being able to hit, with a lot of different, 1,000 cuts will also eventually break a country. And they're very good at breaking degradation. They're not very good at building, but when the ultimate objective for them and victory is sitting at the table as being the most important interlocutor, even if hated, if that's the objective, they're achieving that. And I do think that's their objective. It's not, they know they can't control Libya. I mean, LNA has certainly, we will see how they survive the death of Haftar himself, but he's built a family business around it. Hemeti, if he dies, it's a family business, but he will never control Khartoum or the rest of Sudan. I mean, the RSF is not powerful enough to do that. Same in Somalia. They will never take Mogadishu, but they don't have to. If they control these areas, they say, I'd rather control 100% of a small chunk, than 50% of the overall government of a country. And the same in Yemen. The SDC is certainly not the most powerful country element in Yemen, but there are, outside of the Houthis, certainly an indestructible one. It's one that's there to stay. They will never conquer the rest of the country. But if you compare this to Saudi or Turkey or the US, the UK, and the sort of leverage they have, then it's still better than what they have. So in a network-centric world, it's not necessarily controlling everything, but it's making sure that you can use the networks to make sure that you're the primus inter pares. And I think they've achieved that in all these conflicts.
But what are the risks that they're taking? What are the, what's the danger of blowback, and what would blowback look like?
Yeah, so I'm reputationally, obviously, has been very damaging.
Yes,
I think the UAE are, they are the number one, Cyrus called them a virus or a cancer. Yet they, in the same way that the networks of the Iranians have been very destructive, these networks have been equally destructive. And, they are destabilizing. They destabilize the state-centric order, which is already destabilizing anyway. The blowback, though, is that they're hated across the Arab world, across, I'd say, even the Muslim world. Their relationship with Israel made them even less palatable, and their half-hearted sort of calling Israel out over what they were doing in Gaza and so on and so forth. Extremely unpopular country. They've fallen out with the UK, especially over Russia, but also over Sudan. With the United States, I think they've gone through the, I mean, they had their heydays 10 years ago when they were quite successful. They're quite successful with Trump because he's very transactional and he doesn't really care about philosophy. But nobody asked what's going to happen next. So they've been promising the Trump administration an outcome in Sudan. They're promising him the 13th solved conflict or war that Trump then can use as a badge of saying, oh, I solved another conflict. I don't think they'll be able to bring all parties to the table, by the way. I don't think this is actually an option right now, considering where the conflict is. But that's how they market it in Washington. But Washington is very unstable as well. And so the next administration might look at it very differently. I think the long-term costs, and I think Sudan is, the overreach in Sudan has reached a level now where the mobilization against the UAE is so deep and so wide that I think they need to reconsider. What is interesting, though, is the countries have been in a similar position in 2012, 2013, where they overreached, they realized they overreached, and they did a 180, changed the government, and changed their way of approaching the region. And it was very successful. Saudi in Yemen overreached, realized they couldn't win, 180-degree policy shift, fairly successful. The UAE have, you know, their history is they're doubling down rather than backing down. And that's what they've been doing in Libya, despite the fact that they weren't winning. That's what they've been doing in Yemen, despite the fact that they're not winning by Western conventional standards. And it seems that's what they're doing in Sudan as well. And if they're now doubling down, I think they are miscalculating how bad the blowback will be, because funding a non-state actor in Libya who's, you know, authoritarian is one thing, but funding a genocidal militia that is proud, like bragging about slaughtering civilians, women and children, and putting it on social media, if you're the supporter of this, there is just, you know, a PR way, you know, there's a PR people would say, you cannot polish a turd. And that's the problem with the RSF. This is, you know, this is, there is no narrative that you can put out there to justify this.
They've suffered blowback in a much more direct sense in their neighborhood, in that Iraqi resistance forces and the Houthis have attacked the UAE with drones, forcing them to change their policy. So they've, as a result, they backed off from attacking the Houthis because they're such a vulnerable country.
Right.
I mean, it just takes a few drones to have all the Indians and Pakistanis and guest workers in the UAE panic and go home. Not to mention the Brits and others. Likewise, the Iraqi militias fired a couple of drones and got them to change their policy as well. They don't have a solution for that at the moment. So in the region, they're much more directly vulnerable, very much like the Saudis. If the Houthis hit Saudi water purification or power plants, you've killed Saudi Arabia.
Right. This has been a great discussion, Andres, and I think we can wrap it up here. I really appreciate you coming on Radio War Nerd, and looking forward to your book too. We'll get you back on when your book comes out. Be great to talk to you again. This has been really helpful.
Thank you. Great pleasure. Very, very entertaining.
Thanks. Okay, we're ending the episode here. Thanks again to everyone, and looking forward to talking to John as soon as he is up and ready, which will be soon. Thanks, and thank you to Cyrus for joining as co-host. Thank you to our guest, Andres Krieg.
My pleasure.
I will post links to Andres, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.